Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. A Carolina student writes a bestseller, an international spy mystery. His book takes his readers to Iran, to Afghanistan, to South Africa. In fact, all over the former republics of the Soviet Union, all over the world. And it's a story that's so compelling, it's just really hard to put his book down. So the question is, how did someone so young go so many places, find out so many places, and write such a great book? And so Andrew Britton has agreed to join us and talk about some of the talk about his book and some of these other things. Welcome, Andrew Britton.
Thank you for having me, DG.
I want to call you a Carolina student because you were enrolled at Carolina and you were, I think, planning to come back this fall, but you're writing now. You're not going to come back to Carolina this fall, I guess. Is that right?
It's a little bit late for enrolling now, so I suppose not. But I would like to go back at some point in the near future, hopefully in the spring. But right now, writing is definitely a priority for me because I'm behind on my second book, and I would like to finish that as soon as possible so I can get it into the reader's hands.
Well, the second book is the result of the that your publishers were pleased both with what they when they read your first book and also with the results of it as it's gotten favorable attention. Can you tell us how you happened to write the book?
Well, it's writing is for me. It's really stems from my love of reading. I've always loved to read. From when I was a child, when I remember being 12 years old and reading all my mother's old Jack Higgins books, and I was always interested in those. And as I grew older, I started to really branch out and try to encompass as much as I could when it came to different subjects and topics and authors. So I'm always looking for new people to read, and so really my love of writing just came from that. I never took any classes on how to write. I just took the standard English courses during my entire education thus far, and frankly, I think that if you really want to write, then you just have to do that, and no course can really teach you how.
Well, a lot of writing teachers will tell you that their first piece of advice, it's certainly in the top five advice from every writing teacher I've ever talked to, is read, read, read. That's where you see and learn and gather, first of all, the love for the story and observation about what works and what doesn't for you in terms of the kinds of things that you read.
Absolutely, and I think when you're writing, the story has to come from within. The characters, everything really stems from the characters anyway, but the story has to come within. And the structure is something that you learn from reading. You learn how to organize chapters, how to set things up, and kind of get to from point A to point B. That's something that is just ingrained from years and years of reading different kinds of books. When it comes to characters and stories, you really just have to come up with that straight out of your imagination. There's nowhere else it can come from.
Well, you mentioned your mama's reading. Was she a mystery story or a spy, CIA kind of fan of these intricate plots?
Interestingly enough, she was definitely into the whole spy kind of genre. And it's interesting because a lot of the people that I like to read, guys like Tom Clancy, Vince Flynn, David Baldacci, as a man, I look at those books as being geared towards people in my genre. And yet, I've heard those authors state on many occasions, that their readership is largely based in women.
It's more female than male. My golly. Well, I don't want to get too much off track, but I mean, this is, of course, your first book, but you're getting a lot of fan reaction. And how's this? I would just say, from my limited experience, this is in the Clancy genre that your book, which we'll talk about the story in a minute, but are you finding that this is mostly for men or are women reading this book too?
Well, that is, again, it's interesting because the fan mail that has been forwarded to me from my publisher has been almost entirely composed of letters from women. So it's very interesting to me. I suppose they identify with some of the female characters, which is a huge, I found that it's an honor because as a guy, it's very difficult to write from a woman's point of view, almost impossible. And yet to have them say that I really got that correct is very very rewarding for me.
That's quite interesting. Well, we should, for not everybody who'll be listening will have read your book, The American, and I've expressed surprise that you'd have more female interest than male because these are special forces trained men operating in remote, dangerous areas with enough violence and macho-ness that it appealed to that side of me. So tell us, you've now had a lot of experience telling people enough about your book to attempt them to read it, but not to give everything away. Tell us about this book.
Well, as the novel opens, the U.S. has formed an alliance with France and Italy to kind of curtail the amount of European oil money that's going into Iran, because that money is being used for a secret nuclear project to enhance uranium for use in nuclear weapons. So,
by the way, I don't mean to interrupt you in this story, but you wrote this story now going on 2 years ago, and it was well before the current crisis in terms of the nuclear enrichment activities by Iran. You people, I guess, are calling you a prophet for seeing this, or was this just common sense telling you that that was going to happen?
I like to think it's kind of educated guesswork combined with a little bit of luck. A few things that I put in the novel did come to pass. Very specific things, like the Iranians, that hardline regime took over, and they opened their nuclear plant at Natanz, which is all stuff it's all the information I incorporated into the book. And it just kind of works seamlessly that way. And of course, it's a very bad thing in reality. But
now that it's happened, it looks like it's just you're just copying. But you saw this in advance.
But it's fiction, so you know it works in that kind of field.
Well, I apologize for interrupting you. As this gets started with a sort of change in the Iranian regime that creates a crisis for the Western powers.
That's right. So the U.S. has formed this alliance with France and Italy. And the Iranians obviously are not pleased with this, so they hire a former U.S. soldier by the name of Jason March, who has turned traitor, to conduct terror attacks in the United States. Their first target is the Senate Majority Leader, who is Iran's most vocal opponent on the Hill. And from there, it kind of snowballs, and the CIA determines that March was involved in the attack. And so they bring in their own semi-retired former field operative, who was, in fact, March's commanding officer in the U.S. Army. And the name of their operative is Ryan Keeley, and he is the hero of the story.
He's the – who would you call him? The – like you were mentioning, your mama's hero. He's one of the typical – not typical is not the right word, but he's the hero type from
– He is. And,
who's the closest to in terms of the mystery stories you've written or you've read that –
It's tricky. I don't want to compare him to somebody else because first of all, I have a lot of respect for all the readers, all the people that I've read, and I don't want to take anything away from their stories. But act like.
I'll just say he's like Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford could play him maybe.
Possibly, I suppose, in younger years anyway.
That's right. Yeah,
he's getting a bit on in age.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I saw him the other day in the. His latest, and he looked older than I am. I mean, it was just terrible. Well, go ahead with your story.
Well, so anyway, Ryan Keeley is taken back into the fold, as it were, because he is, as I said, semi-retired. And the reason I don't want to say he's like any of the other people I've read is because he has a very troubling background. He has seen some things in his past. When Jason March went rogue, he killed many people in his detachment. The detachment that Keeley was commanding.
This is a special forces detachment.
That's correct. It's a special forces detachment. And so it's actually based out of Fort Bragg. It's an actual special forces detachment, the 3rd Special Forces Group. And so he was in command of that, actually in command of what they call an Operation Detachment Alpha, which is a unit in the special force. It's like a it's difficult to describe. It's like a squad-based unit.
It's not like the A-team. The old A-teams in the Special Forces were groups of 12.
Well, this is actually, yes, it is a group of 12. So he's actually in charge of that. And March is always, he's one of his soldiers, an E-7 in the U.S. Army. So he goes rogue, and he commits this terrible crime in Syria. And it's years later now. And he's back on the scene. So Keeley is the natural choice to go back after him. But the CIA, of course, has to kind of lure him back in because he doesn't want anything to do with it. Now he's, as I said, semi-retired. He's teaching at a school in Maine. And he is just trying to get on with his life and put the past behind him. But it's proving very difficult.
But there's more to it than that. Can you tell us a little bit about the plot that develops? I mean, really, to kill the president.
Absolutely. Well, as I said, the U.S. has this partnership with France and Italy, So, of course, the leaders of those three countries are natural targets. And the only way that Iran can see to defeat this alliance is to take out the leaderships in the most violent way possible, the most public way possible. And in the end, they choose to do that during a meeting or a speech that takes place in Washington where all three leaders are present.
Try to get them all at once.
And that's this right, on national TV. That's the goal.
Well, I want to talk some more about this book, but let's take a quick break. I'm talking to Andrew Britton, a former student at Carolina, who has written a very commercially successful and critically successful book called The American. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Andrew Britton, who's the author of The American, which is a fictional book, which is an international spy thriller that's gotten great reviews, and it's gotten him a contract for a second book. international success, all pretty good for a Carolina student, or as we said, a former Carolina student, because Andrew's taken another semester, maybe another year off to continue his writing. You're telling us about your book, The American, and the heroes. The anti-hero of this book is a guy named Jason, or at least we think his name is Jason Marsh. And as you mentioned earlier, Marsh is a traitor. I mean, he was in the American Army and in the Special Forces and quite an able soldier. It turns out that all of a sudden he is doing business with these what the current regime would call Islamic terrorist, that group of people, so that take him into the very bowels of the Al-Qaeda movement. And you take, I mean, how do you persuade us that the Al-Qaeda leadership would believe that an American would turn traitor?
I mean, well, it's tricky to do that, of course. And what I aim to do is have them bring him in bit by bit. They don't give him access to the senior leadership right away. He starts out very, very low on the totem pole, and it takes him a long time to work his way into their trust. And even when he is finally brought into the main camp, when he's finally brought into the fold, even then there are members of the senior leadership that do not trust him at all, and they want nothing more than to kill him and leave him out in the middle of the, I don't want to say desert, because that's not where it takes place, the actual meeting. But
in a remote area.
In a very remote area, yes. Actually, it's where I had it placed in it's been a long time since I wrote this.
But these are the mountains of
Tajikistan, actually. Yeah. It's in, on the border between Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, and that's where I wanted to place that, in the Fergana Valley, actually.
As you bring that up, and it reminds me of how current the book is, even though you wrote it, you know, a year or two ago, that these Islamic republics of the former Soviet Union are in the news again as they change sides, either with their Islamic nations that are their neighbors, or with the old Soviet, or the Russia, or with some kind of Western influence. You can just never tell where they're going to go. But they're remote areas that are safe for people.
That's very
all
true.
The time.
These are areas that are safe from the ever-changing governments in the region, and they're safe from the U.S. eyes, both above and on the ground. And of course, the speculation has always been that the senior leadership of Al-Qaeda is somewhere in Pakistan or close on the border there, somewhere in that region. And yet, months and months, years now of searching, and nothing has turned up except for, of course, the lower grade people, the people who Al-Qaeda is willing to sacrifice to keep the U.S. at arm's length. And so it occurred to me that there's a good chance that the senior allocated leadership
might be where you put them.
Is exactly where I put them, somewhere further north where they are free from the constant surveillance and they have the chance to move with a little more freedom, and they don't really have the same dangers, the constant danger. Though, of course, I have them moving around in the book anyway because everyone wants them. We want to know where they are. We want to find them. And really, it takes a lot of planning and a lot of strategy and a lot of constant vigilance for people like that to stay out of our hands.
It's amazing to me. This is totally outside the scope of outside your book. But it's amazing to me that given the fact that much of that territory where we think the Al-Qaeda leadership might be hiding is at least theoretically under the control of people with whom the United States government can work, that that those people, and with all of the technological devices that we have, plus the money that we can pay to people who would turn them in, that after all this time, just can't track them down. Does that puzzle you too?
It is very puzzling, and I think there's so many different reasons, the different factors that play into that. Many senior leadership or U.S. commanders on the ground have stated that things like rewards, and we drop these leaflets all over the place, you know, written in the native language to tell people about the rewards, these huge rewards, $25 million, not even just for bin Laden, but for his deputies. And it's not something that is easily translatable over there, because that kind of money, it's not something that they can conceive of, really. These are people who are born into abject squalor, and they spend their entire youths just trying to make it by, just trying to eke by, make a living, feed their families. That kind of money is not something they can really conceive of. And personal loyalties and loyalties between families and things of that nature over there count for so much more than I think we can really appreciate, given our material climate and things of that nature.
I think that's hard for some of us to understand, but as a culture that puts a lot of stock in terms of how much money you have and the kinds of things that you can buy with money, that there would be a whole culture that couldn't even seduce one person in it to turn rat on one of their colleagues.
Of course, and some people have been seduced by that money. I recall that. One man, I forget his last name, but he was caught in Pakistan several years ago, and he in Islamabad actually. And the U.S. did pay a reward to somebody who turned him in, and then relocated that person out of harm's way because things of that nature.
It'd be tough to do that. Well, as we talk about this, you start. Admiring the qualities of your adversaries, which is a dangerous kind of thing to do. And you tricked me in your book because Jason Marsh, this former Special Forces guy who turned traitor, probably as bad a guy as you'd ever want to imagine. But you had me in this book kind of pulling for him as he dealt with the people that he had to deal with. And even as he develop these really nefarious schemes to harm people that I'm loyal to, I kept thinking, I hope he succeeds. So I kept wondering, is this the device is this a deliberate device that the author is using to trick me into keeping on reading, but all of a sudden I'm pulling for the villain?
Absolutely, and I'm pleased that you would say that, because I really was trying to do that. I really did want to give him a humanistic quality, and actually I was criticized by a few people for that in the past. Before I even had the book published, I sent it out to a few people, and a few publishers actually turned the book down on that basis, on the fact that the villain is a very kind of human, he has human qualities, and you can pull for him in certain ways. But at the same time, he is very much against the United States, against the things that we stand for. And I did want to cast him in a villainous role. And I think I did that. But the thing is, though, is that when he is in, when he is in, when he is in, excuse me, when he's in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, and he's facing these senior al-Qaeda leaders, he is on enemy ground, and he is, even though he's working with them, there's a huge divide there, and he has to gain their trust. And so it's easy for us to kind of pull for him, because he may be a traitor to the United States, but he looks like us, he acts like us, he talks like us, and he is basically an American in a very, very hostile land, trying to earn their trust because he has a hatred for the West that is actually in far excess of anything they feel. And he has very specific reasons for hating the United States and for wanting to cause destruction on U.S. soil. And the reader finds out about that about midway through the book.
So the hatred for the United States, which is a driving force in your book, particularly with the with Jason, the anti-hero that we've been talking about, but that's something that he shares with the al-Qaeda Iranian sort of group of people that he's dealing with.
He shares it, but theirs is an ingrained hatred that is taught from them when it's taught to them as youths, and it's something that's forced, it's drilled into them from the time they can speak, and it's just it starts when they're young, and it's kind of works its way forward, and for him, it's something that happened to him as a child when he was living in South Africa during apartheid. His father was a general in the South African Defense Forces, and an incident occurs when South Africa goes into Angola to repossess the region from black militia leaders. And so an incident occurs there. I don't want to get into it too much because I don't want to give away March's driving force here, his driving motivation. But needless to say, something happened there involving the CIA, and it gave him a reason to hate the United States, and it's something that he pushed down deep inside. And then later, he actually joins the U.S. Army because he wants to learn from the best. He's a very, very complicated person. And as they find out later, as Ryan Keeley and the protagonist find out later, he is a man of many layers. And his hatred is exceeded only by his intelligence. Mm-hmm. And they can only try to catch him and stop him, because trying to understand him would be pointless.
Well, your hero, Orion, is a very interesting and complex character himself. But what you may have done is create the adversary who's even more layers, more complex than your hero. And yeah, you run the risk, even with me, of getting more interested in the bad guy than in the good guy. But that, I mean, again, that sets your book apart, makes it, you know, it makes it different, and maybe for people like me, more interesting, more compelling.
Some people root for the villains when they watch yeah. movies, and I'm one of those people. I do occasionally root for the villains.
I'm talking to Andrew Britton, the author of The American. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Andrew Britton. Andrew is the author of The American. He's right now he's a former Carolina student, because due to the success of The American, he's busy at work on the sequel, or on a second book. We'll talk about whether or not it's a sequel later on, Andrew Britton. Before we do that, can I ask you a little bit about the process of how you got this book out and then how you sold it? I mean, that's a story that many of us who would love to have a successful book. I run into people all the time. I want to write a book, and then once they write it, they want to sell it. And then once they sell it, they want it to be a big commercial success. They want it to have movie rights and all of this. And you're well on your way to achieving that at a younger age than many of us could imagine. How did it happen?
Well, as I said earlier, writing just came from reading. I love to read. And one day back in 2003, October 27th, 2003, I can actually give you the specific day.
Really?
Wow. Because it's on my computer. But anyway, so I started just writing, and I just wanted to see where it went. It was more of a hobby than anything else. But as a few months went by...
You're writing what now? You were just writing scenes, or you're writing... Did you have a little plot in mind, or...
No, I had the basis, the very bare bones of a plot in mind, and I wanted to just kind of see where it would take me. And as I was writing, I saw that it was making perfect sense, and everything was falling into place. That's how you know if something's working, because it just falls right into place when you're writing. The scenes come naturally. Everything kind of blends in seamlessly.
Where were you work-wise, student-wise at this point when you started on this October 27th
That's
or whatever?
Right, October 27th, 2003. I was at Wake Tech at that time. Uh-huh. I was at Wake Tech Community College, and I was in the college transfer program.
So you were, and we're going to school full-time?
I was.
And this was not a high, a break from... school life, your hobby.
It was a way to just kind of unwind, and I just started doing it, and I couldn't stop. And as I said, as the months went on, eventually I decided that I really needed to put more effort into it, because I wanted to complete it. I wanted to finish it and see where it took me. And it did take a long time. It took actually 14 months from start to end, but that time included months and months of revising, rewriting, and editing as well. I sent it off to a private editor to actually have her look at it. She made some great suggestions, and when I finally thought I was ready, I bought every book I could find on how to get published.
Well, let me stop with the editing part of it. That's a real important part that many authors miss, I think, before they start marketing their book. And you're a novice at all of this. How did you tell us the pathway to choose to first of all to know that you needed an editor, and then to the process of choosing somebody to look over your shoulder and tell you what to do?
Well, as I said, I never bought any book on how to write, but I did buy every book I could find on how to get published, because I knew that it would be a very tricky process. I knew it would be difficult. 300 books come out every day, and I knew that if I wanted to get mine published, you only get one chance. That's the main thing. That's the overriding thing that I read in all these books. So you only get one chance to impress a publisher. So you have to get it right the first time. So I spent months and months just trying to get the book exactly where I wanted it to be. And in one of these books I read, it suggested that if you can find a private editor, that might be a good route to go. And I thought it was worth the extra expense. So I started looking around on the internet, and I finally found somebody I thought was reliable.
How did you make that judgment? I mean, are you doing this all by yourself with the internet rather than having some personal mentor or guide with this?
It was tricky, of course, because I didn't know who was reliable and who wasn't. But the person I found, a woman named Linda Cashton in Washington, D.C.
And you found her yourself by... research on the internet.
Through the internet. She runs a company called The Word Process. And I liked her website. I thought it was very professional. She looked like she knew what she was doing, based on my own limited experience, of course. And most importantly, she had written several books herself, which were also fiction books. And her partner in the business had also written several books. So I thought, these are people who have been through the process. Mm. They've done it themselves. They must have, at the very least, some idea of what you have to do to get a publisher's attention. So I sent her the book, and she got back to me about a week later and said she was extraordinarily impressed, which was worth the money I paid her.
Because
it was very reassuring. I felt like I was on the right path, and I could move forward from there. And so I took her advice, and it's very hard to take somebody's advice.
Yeah, well,
when
tell us something. Can you give us an illustration of some of the advice that she gave you that was tough to take, but either and that either you didn't take it or you did take it? Can you illustrate that?
Well, a lot of her advice was very simple. For instance, I had the president of the United States. When I was going into his biography a little bit, I mentioned the fact that his wife had breast cancer and she passed away, and that was a very traumatic event for him. But he's a very secondary character, and so she advised me to take part of that out. And that was easy to do because he, like I said, he's a secondary character. Even I only have a certain amount of feelings for my secondary characters. Everyone's interested in the primary character, so it was easy to do. But
So just trying to make the rule, her advice in the rule was be careful about having too many complexities to characters who aren't going to play an important part in the book, because your reader can only keep up with a limited number.
Yeah.
Is that sort of what she was saying?
In a way, but it's not so much the complexity, but the fact that it really adds the length of the book without contributing too much. It's fine to have a certain amount of complexity, but let's keep it limited to the character in question. And here I was going off about his wife, and it really wasn't necessary.
Wow, that's great. Anything else? Well, tell us, that's a great story.
Well, that's one example, but the tricky part came when she wanted me to take out a 30-page backstory, which was all about my antagonist, Jason March, him growing up in South Africa, and some of the things that kind of contributed to his basically psychopathic behavior that we witnessed later. And it took me an incredibly long time to write this part of the book, and I was frankly impressed with it myself. I thought it was pretty good, and interesting was the main thing. So I wanted to keep it in, but she suggested I didn't. And it was the only thing she advised me that I did not do.
Wow. And how did the discussion go, and did she come to understand more why – I understand from reading the book why that was important. And as we discussed earlier, that's because you seduced me into getting real interested in this anti-hero.
Right.
She respected – of course, I'm sure, a respectful discussion, but did she ever come to agreement with you about this, or did –
No, she never did. She suggested the entire way that I take it out, and I made her corrections, and then I sent it back to her with this one piece left in, this 30-page backstory, right in the middle of the book, and I thought it was interesting. I liked it. And she said, no, again, you have to take that out. It's too long, and it takes away from the plot, because it's right in the middle, and people are going to forget what they're coming back to when it's over. So I left it in, sent it off to my agent. When I had an agent before I had a publisher, I sent it to my agent when we were doing our own private editing. And she said the same thing.
So, your new editor said the same thing?
No, my agent said the same thing.
The agents, okay.
So she was right all along. I had to take it out, and I did. It's not in the final book.
Well, but that's not quite true, because there's a lot of background information about Jason March that you slipped in some other way.
There is. I had to take 30 pages and condense it down into 3 or 4, and it was kind of tricky. But I'm very happy with the way it turned out. I think it really gives the reader a good idea of what created him, what caused him to have this, as I said, very deep, very strong hatred for the United States. And it's not grounded in something that we think about. We look at Al-Qaeda, we look at people in the Middle East who have this hatred for us, and we can't understand it because it's not based in something that we can.
Wow. Well, we got to take a break, but I'm not through with this topic. This is interesting. I'm talking to Andrew Britton, the author of The American. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Andrew Britton, the author of The American, a wonderful, compelling international spy mystery that I couldn't put down. We're talking a little bit about my curiosity about how you wrote the book and how you sold it. Maybe this is just too much of an intricate part of writing the book to talk about in such detail, but it fascinates me about this 30-page segment on your anti-hero that your agent and your editor persuaded you finally to eliminate from the book, or to condense, I guess, into the book. Now, right now you're in the process of writing a second book, and is it a sequel sort of to this?
It is a sequel, actually. Again, it's tricky to say it's a sequel without giving away too much, because obviously some of these characters survive, but yes, it is a sequel, and it involves the same hero, Ron Keeley, and the woman he's working with at CIA. It's a British-born analyst by the name of Naomi Carmine, and And Jason March is back again.
Jason March is back. All right, well, here's what I want to ask you, and that is you had those 30 pages that they made you take out. I bet you there are a few of those pages that are slipping back in as you give more background information about Jason March in this book. Am I right?
Definitely. I really wanted to expand on his past and to give the reader an even better idea.
You got more leverage now because you got a successful first book and you got your contract. I mean, you do have a little more leeway, a little more strength, don't you? Maybe a little bit more. I know something more about this than I did when I was talking to y'all before.
Absolutely. It really helps to just have that one book out there. It really has given me a lot of insight about how the publishing industry works. And I've attended a lot of trade shows and I've met with a lot of other authors and a lot of people in the publishing industry. So it's really helped me to kind of get a better idea.
Talking about the things that you learned when the book was finished, that your private editor, your agent were satisfied with it, and then how did they and you sell it to a publisher?
That was really all just came down to my agent. She that's all agents do pretty much is they, if they're in New York, they lunch every day with editors and they talk about books coming up and different things like that. So we actually had an auction. They sent it out and they had an auction. And
so she felt strong enough about it that it was going to be, it wasn't, I got to find somebody, but this book is going to sell. And so we'll just see who'll pay the most for it.
No, there was quite a few bidders. Actually, Neil Nyren, Tom Clancy's editor, he bid on it for a while. And eventually came down to Kensington. They offered the most, and they were most interested.
Was the auction – I'm sorry to be so curious about the business aspects of this. Was it an auction, like an auction in the sense – or was it a sealed bid kind of auction, or did they just say, we're going to
– There was – I think there was – I'm not sure how auctions work myself, to be honest, but I think there was a deadline. And when it came down to the deadline, the person who had offered the most and was most interested – it's not just money. It comes down to – the number of books they want as well, then...
You mean the number of books that they would print? They would tell you...
Well, no, not the number of books they would print.
The number of books
they want you to write. That's right. The number of books they want you to write. And it ended up being a 3-book contract. So this is the sequel, and I'd like to keep going with the main character after that, and we'll see where it goes.
We talk about the amount of the advances, but is it true that the real compensation comes from selling a lot of books? I mean, isn't that what you really want to do?
Actually, well, of course, that is what you want to do. But believe it or not, for many authors, in fact, the overwhelming majority of authors, the advance is the only money they ever see because there's so many books being printed and there's so much competition in the marketplace that it's very difficult for a person to
outsell his advance.
Exactly. Especially if the advance is rather large, which sometimes happens. Especially if books do go to auction, then publishers tend to actually sometimes overpay authors. So then they actually end up with a loss because maybe the book doesn't sell quite as well as they thought it did, or maybe it exceeds expectations. It all comes down. It's very unpredictable business,
yeah.
I think.
But in the case of the auction itself, if you sell a lot of books, enough to pay for the advance, then the amount of the advance doesn't matter as much, other than meeting current living expenses.
Well, that's true. Of course, that's what every author aspires to. You want to sell as many copies as you can. And, of course, the more copies you sell, the more money you make as a percentage off the book sales.
Well, what did you learn, or what have you learned, what are you learning as an author whose compensation depends not only on your writing a good book, but also on promoting the book that you've written? What kinds of things did your publisher ask you to do, and that you found helped in making sales on the book?
Some things I think helped, and some things didn't. I did attend a few readings, and generally speaking, a lot of readings are not widely attended, and so you can't help but feel as if you could have done something more productive with that time. But then, on the other hand, it's always great meeting readers. Even if you travel 50 miles and you get to talk with a few people, if they're really interested in the book and they want to talk to you about it and they have questions and they're enthused, then that's a trip worth making. And I like to do that. I like to talk to readers. And I'm actually working on doing that, getting my website to the point where readers can talk to me directly as opposed to having to go...
Having a little blog type of thing that you...
Maybe, or even just an email address that people could talk to me directly instead of going through my publisher.
Uh-huh.
But of course, right now, I don't have the time to talk to anybody because I'm so busy with the second book.
We're about out of time, and you got to get back to writing. What kind of What is your schedule as you are in the midst of writing? How do you order your day so that you don't just wear yourself out writing, but at the same time you apply it to the task? And how do you keep going when the writer's block occurs?
That the writer's block, fortunately for me, and I know there's a thing that if you even say it, then it could happen. But you know, it's fortunately for me, that's not a problem right now. Everything seems to be flowing much better because I'm very close to the end here. Less than 20 pages, I'll be finished, which I'm looking forward to. And right now, I'm working solely at night. I start about 6 p.m. and I go right through to about 9 a.m. in the morning. In fact, I've been up for quite a bit.
So we're recording this in the morning, and you're at the end of the day then.
I'm at the end of the day.
So when do you go to sleep? I mean,
I try to sleep about 9 in the morning until about 6 at night. So I'm getting plenty of sleep, but my apartment is very noisy. The only time I actually have any private time is at night. So I actually have to sleep when it's noisy and work when it's quiet.
Well, I got 1,000 other questions. How about research? You had to do an incredible amount of research for the American. Or you found out that you've now can not do as much research because you did it so much for the American.
Not so much. I find the research very interesting, but I think David Baldacci, who is one of my favorite writers, once said that he becomes a temporary expert when he's writing a book, and when it's done, he forgets it all.
Wow.
And of course, I can't really do that because things that I learned in the first book are applicable to the second.
Yeah, you better remember what you wrote.
Exactly.
Well, golly, Andrew Britton, thanks for taking time from your writing schedule to come visit with your friends here in Chapel Hill. Great success. Congratulations on the success of your first book and lots of success on the second one.
Thanks for having me, DJ. Appreciate it.
I sure enjoyed it. And thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.